You're listening to the Life in Deep Ellum podcast, exploring the sacred in art, faith, and community. Enjoy this sermon from Joel Triska.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to the new year. So typically, we celebrate this in the church calendar as the Day of Epiphany, which is actually not till January 6th. But today, we're going to talk about that. And I decided that I was going to go ahead and recycle a sermon. We like to recycle around here. And I figured this is the sermon I preached last year on Epiphany, but 2020 was such a butt kicker that most of you probably forgot all the lessons anyway. So let's do this again. I think it'll be pretty applicable. So I started with this idea, this story that I heard. It was a very successful woman who was giving an address to a group of alumni from Harvard. So Harvard alums, high achieving people. And she was talking to them about the merits of failure, how failure was sort of like a gift in her life. And she said it this way: eventually, we all must come to a decision for ourselves about what represents failure. However, the world is very keen to put failure on a schedule and give you a set of decisive factors if you allow it. A meager 7 years following my graduation, she said, failure had hit me on a grand scale. A fleeting marriage was dissolved. I had no job. I was a single parent and as destitute as anyone could possibly be without living on the streets. My parents' fears for me and those I had for myself had finally transpired. And according to the book of failure, I was the biggest. So the woman addressing these Harvard alums was none other than J.K. Rowling, the famous author of Harry Potter novels and considered history's first billionaire author, B with a B. And her point was that failure is actually not that unusual. Actually, it's quite normal. I think we can all relate to the idea of failure being normal. And in her case, it might actually be considered a gift, as it led to her taking a stab at a writing career, which worked out for her. Gifts are like that. They sometimes look like something else. They're opportunities in disguise. But really, they are God's way of guiding us, of helping us face challenges, inviting us into deeper, true purpose, growth. It's like Harry Potter, who came face to face with Lord Voldemort, Tom Riddle, in the Chamber of Secrets. What, you don't know what I'm referring to? Allow me to remind you. 10-year-old Harry, confronted by Tom Riddle, he who must not be named, the most evil wizard in the history of the world, Lord Voldemort. Harry tries to show bravery in the face of this danger, but all that appears to help him is Forks, the pet phoenix of Dumbledore, carrying in its beak the moldy old hat of the Sorting Hat. And, Tom Riddle laughs. Is this all that Dumbledore has to offer you? A songbird and a moldy old hat? Harry doesn't know what these gifts are for, but he reaches into the hat and he pulls out the sword of Gryffindor. Come on. But then the giant snake, the basilisk, appears and Forks goes up, pecks its eyeballs out, but Harry then takes a sword and drives it through the head of the basilisk, but one of the fangs gets into his arm, poison goes in his arm, he's gonna die. Tears of the Phoenix drips onto Harry's arm. He's okay. He takes a fang that was in his arm about to kill him, and he puts it into the diary, which is actually a horcrux we find out in book 6, and Lord Voldemort is defeated for that book. First, I love the Harry Potter novels, and I don't really care who knows. Other than the Bible, I know those books better than anything else, any other book, and the difference is marginal. 2, gifts are not always what they appear to be at first. You know, J.K. Rowling said, at some point, we must all determine what represents failure. And on this day of the Magi, I might add that we all must determine what represents a gift. You know, Epiphany, also known as Three Kings Day, is on January 6th, 12 days after Christmas. And I know it's not January 6th today, but since we're closest to then, we're going to talk about it. This is the day where the ancient church celebrated the arrival of the Magi as they greeted young Jesus with gold, frankincense, and myrrh, gifts. So I'm going to open up to Matthew chapter 2. This is how Matthew told the story. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." So here we are introduced to the Magi. Notice they are not called kings, right? Nor are we told that there are three of them. Later, Christians start calling them kings. They were kind of referencing back to Psalm 72, where it says all kings will bow down to him. But even then, we aren't told how many of them there are. In the Eastern Church, they actually claimed that there were 12, which was a symbolic number for completion. It was the Western tradition that said three in reference to the three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. The word magi obviously doesn't mean kings, right? The word magi comes from the Greek magos. It means magician or wizard. So you see, a Harry Potter reference at the beginning of my sermon is not only permissible, it is theologically appropriate. All right, so in the East, magi were leading figures in the religious court. Yeah, these kind of wizards that were sages, they relied on, kings would, and royalty would rely on them for their wisdom in diplomatic matters, as well as their scientific knowledge, in those days would just be called astrology. And I said astrology, not astronomy. In the ancient world, they still thought the earth was flat and the skies could be read like tea leaves, which leads us to this fascinating supposed star that they said would it rose and they followed it. Now, these magi weren't merely looking at the sky and decided to follow some weird phenomenon. This wasn't their only data point. They also would have been familiar with the Hebrew scriptures. Many Jews still lived in the Babylonian area due to leftovers from the exile. And notice they were the ones who asked Herod explicitly, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews?" That was their question. A lot of information we hear in that question. A star couldn't have told them that. The Hebrew scriptures did. The book of Numbers says that a star will come out of Jacob, a scepter will rise out of the east. But what was this star? There's a pretty popular documentary that's come out in the past decade or so that argues that the Star of Bethlehem was likely an unusual alignment of planets that occurred around 7 BC. Others have argued that it may have been a supernova, because we have records of Chinese and Korean astrologers recording that around 5 BC. But we also should be open to supernatural explanations. I'm not saying it wasn't a star or a supernova. I'm only saying it is us in our culture that are obsessed with science and trying to make it fit that. We study astronomy. They studied astrology. They didn't know stars were actually burning balls of gas millions of light years away. They saw them as mysterious signs to be interpreted. And if God can lead the Israelites with a cloud by day and fire by night, why could he not lead the wise man with a supernatural star or an angel of light, which, by the way, angels are often called stars in the Bible? Which is it for me? I don't know that it matters. First, I don't need science to help me believe an ancient narrative. Right? That's like asking a modern economist to validate the message of a wise elder in a rural African village. They just saw the world differently, and that's okay. Both have truth to speak. They just use different data points and experiences. Second, the point of the story isn't the star, right? The point is Jesus and how respected non-Jewish royal experts travel across the known world to see him. That's how the ancient world would have read that story. This is validation for Jesus' birth. The Messiah isn't just a local affair. His birth was felt almost 2,000 miles away. Okay, continuing on, chapter 2, verse 3. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. And the Magi came from the east to Jerusalem, and they asked, when he had called them all together, all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people and Israel." Then Herod called back the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and search carefully for this child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." You almost see him like twirling his mustache right there. So just the Magi, they are encouraged to talk to Herod. Now Herod, guys, he's a nasty figure. And at this point in his life, it's towards the end of his life, where he became famously paranoid. He thought everyone was trying to usurp his power. He even had family members killed to protect his position. So no wonder all Jerusalem got disturbed when he was disturbed. They're like, "Ooh, who's he going to kill now?" So when Herod was disturbed, bad things tend to happen. Still, he had incentive to learn more about the supposed king of the Jews. Notice, he didn't challenge their belief that a king was born. He didn't say that didn't happen, or "I don't believe in that." He's like, "Oh, tell me more." He believed it. So he called his scholars in to help, and they were able to narrow down the prophecy for the Magi, not just a king in the land of Jacob, but the prophet Micah said it would be in the tiny town of Bethlehem, the town of David. But immediately, we see the duplicity of Herod and his motives. He says, "I want to go worship this king too." But everyone else knew he wanted to eliminate the threat of another king. But the Magi weren't familiar with local politics, so they had no reason to not trust him. Verse 9, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. When they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. So much in this story. So just like an angel appeared to Joseph in a dream to tell him that it was okay to marry his already impregnated fiancée, the Magi apparently had some sort of dream, a vision, that warned them about Herod's duplicity. The Magi only had to travel 6 miles from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, and somehow a star rested over Jesus' location. I'm not sure how that happens, which for me is maybe the strongest argument against a natural phenomenon. Stars don't rest over small locations, okay? How does a star do that? Again, not sure it matters. The ancient world wouldn't have been bothered by that detail, so I won't be. The word for child here in the Greek actually refers to a toddler. This is because Jesus was not in a manger when they got there. They were in a house in Bethlehem. Right there in verse 11, it says a house. And it's hard to reconstruct how old Jesus was at the time, but we know the trip from the Magi was at least several months long. So however long the star was in the sky before the Magi decided to follow it, plus their long journey, plus their stay in Jerusalem while they're looking to figure out what to do next, the next thing we know is that Herod would famously order that all children under the age of 2 be slaughtered. So most scholars guesstimate that Jesus was between 1 and 2 years old, somewhere in there. And they bring these gifts, 3 of them, the kind of gifts that they would have been offered to royalty. Here's how I think it would. The first 2 magicians stepped forward and bowed down. And in each of their hands was an ornate box. And it was a somber event. Mary and Joseph were amazed as the men opened the box. Like, "We bring you gold. We bring you frankincense." Then the third burst out onto the scene and said, "But wait, there's myrrh." Dad joke. Anyway, these gifts were obviously valuable and prized throughout the ancient world. Can I just say, I'm tired of telling jokes and not getting feedback from anyone laughing. I have to laugh just so that I don't feel like I'm crazy. Anyway, these gifts were obviously valuable and prized throughout the ancient world. Gold was precious metal back then, just as it is today. Frankincense and myrrh were both luxurious fragrances that were used for multiple purposes, but here's what I want to pivot into my main point. Gifts, guys, gifts. Obviously, we have three clear gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But I want to look at the entirety of the story and make a couple observations about the nature of gifts. Because gold, frankincense, and myrrh aren't the only gifts in this story. If we look closer, I think we can see that there are way more than three gifts. So observation number one, tests are gifts. Tests are gifts. You know, for the Magi, the journey was a test. They not only had to embrace the physical toll the trip would take, but they also had to all this potentially wasted time. I mean, because they had no guarantee that this trip would be anything more than a wild goose chase. So the journey was a test of their endurance. It was a test of their faith, but they embraced the test. Now, how many of you have read Jesus's parables? They're fun stories, but sometimes enigmas, like they're hard to understand. They're some of my favorite passages in the whole Bible because they're pictures of God's vision. And I used to think that Jesus was trying to make God's vision plain to us through these parables. He's trying to make it easier to understand. He used agricultural metaphors about sheep and seeds so that his audience could better understand it. But according to Jesus himself, his intentions were exactly the opposite. In both Matthew and Mark, the disciples ask about the parable of the sower. If you remember, there's four different soils that seed goes into. And Jesus clearly says that while he speaks plainly with the disciples, he intentionally does not speak so to everyone else. What? Why? Because, and I quote, "Though seeing, we don't see. Though hearing, we don't understand." Geez, Jesus, take it easy. Is he saying that his parables aren't meant to reveal truth? No, he's saying that before he reveals the truth, first he conceals it. He wraps it in a story. Like God showing up as a vulnerable baby born to a poor family, he wraps the truth in ordinary parables. He hides the most valuable and beautiful truths of the universe in stories about a prodigal son or angry vineyard workers. Like a pirate who buries his treasure, if you want to know the truth Jesus is teaching, first, you're going to have to dig a little bit. So who here likes to dig? Not many people do. I mean, I once had to use a post hole digger. You know, I was helping build a fence. And, you know, there's kind of like a satisfying moment, you know, at the beginning where you're just like, you're doing this and you look down and you're like, look, I made a hole. I made that, right? But after like three or four holes, it stopped being fun, you know? My hands hurt. It makes my back ache. Digging is work. But it is the mysterious way God has ordered his universe. Seeking comes before finding, right? There is no finding without seeking. We cannot find what we so desperately long for by sitting idly by. We must get off our bums and go on a journey. Find the truth, no matter what the cost. It's like a man who accidentally uncovers a treasure in a random field. He goes and sells everything he has to buy that field so that he can then own the treasure. Jesus said that. It's a parable. Now, I know it's cliche, but obstacles are opportunities. They refine us like fire. Think about 2020 and the kind of heat that put on us. There are impurities in gold. But the only way to get the impurities out is to put the gold under intense heat so that it melts and the impurities rise to the surface. Think about how many of our impurities rose to the surface this past year. So good teachers give homework. Good therapists give homework. Good pastors give homework. Do they? I don't know. Why? Because tests are gifts. All right, so the second observation, people are gifts. Now, this one may seem like obvious to you. Like, I think most of us intuitively apply this truth, but I think we also apply it sparingly. We believe that some people are gifts. We qualify it. But surely not all of them, right? They're not all gifts. I mean, look at the story of the Magi. I'm sure they thought their entourage were gifts. And obviously Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, gifts. But what about Herod? I mean, that dude was a grade A douche magoosh. But while Herod was an unqualified, wicked person, he too was a gift. Think about it. Were it not for him, the Magi would not have been introduced to the scribes, who then helped them narrow down the search to Bethlehem. Even Herod had a role to play in the Epiphany story. Sure, not everyone may be of equal value in terms of being a gift, but for those with eyes to see and those with ears to hear, we see that God can speak through anyone. God can offer support and assistance through anyone. It's simply a matter of perspective. I mean, how many of you guys get annoyed when people try to stop you on the sidewalk and sell you something? Like, I hate it. Absolutely hate it. So last year, our family went to San Antonio for a couple days. We went on the river walk. And it was a Christmas gift for our girls. So that was just a gift, and all the people were a gift. We went to SeaWorld, and yes, I've already seen the documentary Blackfish, right? Horrible story. It moved me, and I still had fun at SeaWorld. Sue me. Sorry. But as we were meandering the river walk, all these salespeople would try and stop me, right? They'd start with a normal question like, can I help you with anything? First, I'm just walking on the sidewalk, you know, so I'm not sure that I need help with that. My legs are functional. Thank you. But my natural reaction is to be a polite human, right? So they kind of count on that. They count on the decency of people. And then I'm like, no, thank you. And then they will say something like, how long are you staying in San Antonio? What? Why is that your business, Mr. Stranger, I've never met before? Just because I give you eye contact does not mean that I'm inviting you into my private life. Would you also like my social security number? So I usually get flustered and turn back and say something like, I'm not interested, and just like say it as semi-rudely, which is about as rude as I can get. But after the third time this happened, I turned to Rachel and I said, I hate it when people force me to be rude to them. I just hate it. Why are you forcing me to be rude to you? But guess what? Those people are gifts too. They are. I'm not saying I appreciate their unapologetic intrusions or obvious attempts to take advantage of my Mayberry manners, but let's be honest, they probably hate their jobs more than I hate their jobs. And if I take a moment to reflect on my own spiritual path, I have to be honest, they are actually helping me. They are giving me opportunities to face my own internal fear of conflict. They give me practice asserting my voice in a kind, respectful way. I hate every second of it, but if I'm going to grow, I need people like them. Try it next time. When someone is frustrating you, just say it out loud. That dude, Fred, he's a gift. Jennifer, she's such a gift. Just say it out loud. It helps. People are gifts. All right, third observation. Gifts are gifts. What I mean by this is that sometimes the value of gift is not really clear at first, right? I remember one of the first Christmases I spent down with Rachel's family, and I was just getting to know her brothers, and I couldn't help but feel like we came from different worlds. You know, they grew up in the country shooting guns. I grew up in the suburbs playing video games. They learned to drive on four-wheelers. I learned to drive on a golf cart. All right. At the time, both of them were in the army, and the present Rachel's older brother, Josh, got for me was something that he found at the army surplus store on his base. And he showed it to me, and after I opened it, and it's like this little keychain that opens up like a small little Leatherman. He's like, look, it can turn into scissors. And I was polite about it, you know, but I didn't see the value. I didn't carry a pocket knife. That's just not what I did. I didn't grow up in the country. I don't carry a pocket knife. Sorry. But I put it on my keychain as a sign of appreciation. Do you know what? I used the mess out of that keychain. Like, it became one of the most useful things I've ever owned. It was awesome. It was like every other day, someone within my earshot would say something like, does anyone happen to have a knife or scissors? And I'd be like, yes to both. Pow. This past year for Christmas, Rachel got me this little pouch. See it right here? And if you zip it open, it has like silverware in it. Like there's a fork, a spoon. I had a knife in here, but it got taken away from the air. TSA took it from me. But it's neat. And she got it for me. Got one for all the girls. And I thought, I'll never use this. Why would I ever need silverware? Just going random places. But while we were in San Antonio last year, I went out and got some ice cream for the girls. I went down, left our hotel room, got a treat for the girls, got some ice cream at a CVS or something. And I came back. And then moments later, Haven comes in crying because her plastic spoon had broken in the frozen ice cream. And I thought, well, shoot. And then Rachel looked at me and said, I did get you that gift. And I had it in my backpack. And her gift was a gift. You hear me? Gifts are gifts, even if we don't immediately see the value. Now, the early church fathers, early church father Irenaeus, traditionally interpreted the three gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh from the Magi. And he said that the gold represented kingship. The incense represented Jesus's deity because incense was used in religious rituals. And myrrh, which was something sometimes used in burial preparations, it represented Jesus's death. So kingship, religious rituals, deity, death. Now, it's a nice interpretation. However, the Magi didn't know Jesus was anything more than an earthly king, right? That couldn't have been their intent. While we might see those gifts as divine in hindsight, it surely wasn't the intentions of the Magi. And it surely wasn't what Mary and Joseph would have seen. And they were just as confused about what was happening as everyone else. And I'm sure Mary and Joseph were honored. These were presents for royalty, right? But what good are they to impoverished folk? Why would Mary put on expensive frankincense to smell good when they're trying to put food on the table? But those gifts had value, financial value. And when Herod decreed that all children under two were going to be slaughtered, Mary and Joseph had to flee with their son to Egypt. And I wonder how they afforded that expensive transition. Perhaps under the sovereign hand of our God, those gifts provided the financial means for Jesus' family to flee and stay there until Herod's decree blew over. We may not always see the value at first, but tests are gifts, people are gifts, and gifts are sometimes bigger gifts than we ever could possibly imagine. And in many cultures, Epiphany has its own traditions. Some people will burn their Christmas trees in a bonfire of festivities. Some people bake a cake with a figurine of the baby Jesus in the center. I'm serious, a little figurine of baby Jesus in the center, the Rosco de Reyes. My favorite is where the kids will leave out their shoes, right? It's sort of like stockings, but instead of leaving stockings empty, they fill their shoes with hay. This is supposedly for the camels that carry the Magi so that they have something to eat. They wake up the next morning and there's treats and trinkets in their shoes. It feels like transactional. You know, I give you something that you like, you give me something that I like. And while there's a time and a place for transactional economics, I tend to think that God wants us to know He works differently. There is a reason we call God's love unconditional. This is the way I like to say it to my girls. I tell them, there's nothing that you can do to make me love you more. And there's nothing you can do to make me love you less. My love for you is as much as it possibly can be, always and forever. And I say that to them because that's how I believe God loves me. And for those who don't know, I play guitar. I picked it up the summer before my senior year of high school. My best friend, Benji, had just started, so he was like trying to get me into it. And he and I went to a local pawn shop to look at different selections of guitar. And I was relying on my friend Benji, who knew just a little bit more about guitars than I did, because I didn't know anything. And we found like a Yamaha guitar at this pawn shop, and it was for $250. And we're like, okay, that's a nice guitar, but I only have $200 on me. But I knew I was going to be working that week. I was umpiring baseball at the time, so I knew I would come back with at least $250 the next week. So a week later, Benji and I went back to that same pawn shop store, but much to my disappointment, that Yamaha guitar was gone. It was missing. Someone had bought it in a week? Seriously? But right in its place was another guitar for $199, and it was an Alvarez, and it was beautiful. It looked way better than the Yamaha. I felt like I'd made the discovery of a lifetime. It's like, I can't believe this, a cheaper guitar that's better? So I bought it immediately. You know that feeling when you like unearth a great deal? You like brag about it to everyone else? Like, look what I found. I carried that guitar everywhere. In my little case, I would carry it everywhere. I practiced chords, learned how to play. Lord, I lift your name on high. Came from heaven to earth to show the way, all right? And a couple years later, I was talking with my friend Benji. Oh, so this, I would have had that guitar maybe 4 or 5 years. And Benji let something slip while he was talking about something that made me go, wait, what? And I started questioning him further. And it was pretty clear he was trying to like cover up what he said. Finally, after my prodding, he came out with the truth. Unbeknownst to me, he played a huge role in me finding that Alvarez. What I didn't know was that the day after Benji and I left the pawn shop, the first time, Benji went back with the intention of paying $100 down on that Yamaha guitar so that I could buy for less, thinking that the pawn shop owner would have lowered the price. What he saw was this Alvarez guitar for $300. And so he told, somehow convinced the pawn shop owner, hide the Yamaha and mark this Alvarez guitar $100 cheaper, here's $100, and only sell it to my friend when I come here with him. And that's how I got the guitar. It wasn't even close to being my discovery. And I was stunned when I first found this out. Honestly, I felt a little stupid at first. All these years that I was assuming that this was my brilliant discovery, when what was really at play was a beautiful act of unselfishness and kindness. I'd been carrying around a big fat lie in a guitar case. It wasn't something I earned. It was a gift. And I want to suggest that we are all carrying around gifts that we don't recognize as gifts. In fact, our lives are bursting with the grace of God's unconditional love. There is nothing we can do to make him love us more. There's nothing we can do to make him love us less. And to close, I thought I'd just kind of like introduce you to my guitar. It's an Alvarez. I hold that at my house and sing to my daughters at night. And maybe we can sing together this song if you know some of the words. Hopefully I can remember it. I try to memorize it. We three kings of Orient are bearing gifts we traverse afar. Field and fountain, moor and mountain, following yonder star. Oh, star of wonder, star of night, star with royal beauty bright, westward leading, still proceeding, guide us to thy perfect light. I love you guys, and I hope you take some time today to reflect on the gifts that God has given you, like the tests that are gifts, the people who are gifts, and some of the gifts that you received this year, which hopefully you'll discover are way bigger gifts than you possibly could have imagined. So, now to him who's able to keep you from falling, to present you before his glorious presence without fault and with great joy, to the only God, our Savior, be glory, power, majesty, and authority through Jesus Christ, our Lord, now and forevermore, throughout all the ages. Amen. Blessings, guys. Love you very much.